Please the court. Considering there's no shortage of error in this case, really beginning from the point this hospital bill was coded up to the present, it doesn't surprise me what cause number this case was given as 666. So I'd like to discuss, really in reverse order, the points that I raised in my briefing. I had the privilege of serving as a briefing attorney at the Texas Supreme Court, and I was given a case that had 28 points of error and it was over 100 pages long. And I suggested that we grant the 28th point of error. The court, in fact, did that and reversed it per curiam. And so I'm going to pick my last issue here in hopes that lightning will strike twice. And that issue is the burden of proof that was provided by the ALJ in this case. And that spills over into a couple of other issues, including what is de novo and what is evidence in these cases as they come from, I don't want to say from the division to SOA, because in these cases, it's important to note, I think, that this is still, once we get to the ALJ, it's still within the division because the ALJ renders the decision for the agency. The decision we get from the medical review division, once it's quote-unquote appealed or that we ask for a de novo hearing, it really no longer exists. It's not enforceable. It's not binding pending appeal. It's there. And traditionally what happens is that the ALJs have always considered that decision to establish the used for jurisdictional purposes, establish what the issues are and who the parties are. And they've never taken the facts in those cases as determined by the medical dispute resolution officer, the MDRO, as we call them, as facts in the case. It's a de novo hearing. We start all over. We retry the issues. But in this case, not only did the ALJ reverse the burden of proof to the carrier to disprove the amount that was due for this bill, they also said, well, you have to disprove what the MDRO said. And in this case, the hospital put on absolutely no evidence of what they were due under the fee guideline.
Well, counsel, just big picture, because it's a de novo review, we put on blinders, arguably, start over. It was the carrier seeking relief, not having to pay the extra 20 grand in that proceeding, the de novo proceeding.
Well,
how do we
that
get past
gets
that basic concept?
Well, that is not the concept of de novo. If you look at the Manbeck case, which is the most recent case of the Supreme Court that talked about what the nature of the appeal is in this case, or in these types of cases, there the Austin Independent School District had been ordered by the department to pay attorney's fees. They asked for a de novo hearing regarding that order. And because they were a governmental entity, they said, we don't have to pay those, we have immunity. But there'd be an exception to that if, in fact, they were asking for affirmative relief. And the court said, well, no, in these de novo hearings, in this case, ASD was ordered to pay something, and they asked for a de novo hearing, and the court said it's not proper to say they're asking for affirmative relief. All they're asking for is a retrial of the issues below. And if you look at the Southern Canal case and Cortez, what they say is the de novo means you're retrying the issues that underline the decision below. You're not looking at the decision below. You're retrying the issues that supported that order. And so the nature of de novo has always been, certainly in the context of workers' compensation, if you look at the history, going back to 1913, until 1991, we lived in a de novo world in workers' comp because the decisions that came out of the department back then, the IAB, were cursory. We had some very informal hearings. We called them pre-hearings. No evidence was put on. We just kind of discussed the case. And the pre-hearing officer would make a recommendation as to what the loss of wage earning capacity was, et cetera. And then one of the parties would routinely appeal that. And if the carrier appealed that decision, if they had been ordered in that award to pay something, it didn't matter whether the carrier appealed it or whether the claimant appealed it, the burden of proof was still always on the healthcare provider if there was a bill involved, and the claimant if we were talking about income benefits. And that had always been the case. And what we did as a practical matter in those days, if there was an award for the carrier to pay a certain amount and the carrier appealed it, once we appealed it into court, we would rearrange the parties and the claimant would become the plaintiff. And that's typically what was done either by motion or most of the time the courts did it on their own motion to realign the parties, knowing that the healthcare provider and or the claimant always had the burden of proof. It didn't matter who appealed it. And so you could say, yeah, we're appealing essentially an order from the agency, but in reality or not, because what Southern Canal said was the sine qua non of de novo is that that order from below doesn't exist anymore. You start all over with not only the facts, but the law as well. The whole thing's de novo. And so in Manbeck, what the court said that it's a mistake to say that the appealing party, in that case the school district, was seeking affirmative relief. All they were doing was taking advantage of a procedural remedy they had to determine whether they owed attorney's fees or not. And you started all over. They weren't seeking affirmative relief. And that's exactly the grounds or the reason the ALJ in this case said, I'm assigning the burden of proof to the carrier here because they're seeking affirmative relief. Well, Manbeck says we're not. All we're doing is asking for a retrial of the issues that supported the order below.
So does the question of harm come into play at all on that burden shifting?
Well, in this case.
And if so, how is the carrier harmed?
Well, in this case, it's manifest. The hospital put on no evidence. What the ALJ said, it was the carrier's burden to disprove what the MDRO said below. Now, I don't get to depose the MDRO, and if in fact that's now evidence, it never has been before, but if that's evidence, we're going to spend a lot of time with the MDROs fleshing out how they came to their numbers. In this particular case, involved the MDRO's numbers, how she came up with particularly the outlier calculations. It's a very complicated calculation. I'm not going to go into the details of what outliers.
We don't have anything in the record as to the basis of that claim.
We do have her decision, but the point is there's big gaps. And in fact, she starts out and says, I've forgotten the figure, but I think it's 20,000 and change, she says, for allocated cost. We don't know how she got there. Now, we were able to back calculate some things, and we got pretty close, I think, and in doing so with my expert. By the way, they didn't have any expert or challenge my expert at all. So when you talk about harm, mm-hmm. they put on no evidence at any stage what they were due under the fee guideline. And one reason they didn't do that, because that wasn't the issue when we went into dispute resolution. It never was, because it was a question of what they were due under a contract. And under the rules, if you had a contract, you don't default to anything else. You do it per the contract. And so the MDRO, as you see in her decision, she voided the contract, even though the hospital hadn't challenged the fact that the contract applied at that point. They only decided to do that after they got the decision orders to pay $20,000 when their demand at the informal stages was an additional $748. And then the MDRO voided the contract, calculated all this, miscalculated it. And again, that's the problem I've got with the harm, because in this particular case, literally they put on no evidence of any kind as it relates to how much was due under the fee guideline. They didn't do it at the informal stage, they didn't do it at the MDR stage, and they didn't do it at SOA, even though they had a witness there that claimed he knew how to do this and knew how to calculate outlier. They put on no evidence what would have been due, or that the outlier calculations that we went through, my expert proffered, were incorrect in any way. So they didn't contradict a single thing we did as it relates to those calculations. So that's the harm as to what happened here.
But in any event, based on your explanation of the, your description of the process as the party requesting relief at the agency once the de novo hearing is requested, anything that the initial officer may have arrived at is legally irrelevant. The button is reset, and it is still the hospital that is requesting relief, and therefore they shoulder the burden of proof.
That's exactly correct. And the point also is that in our 1989 reforms that were effective in 1991, the legislature took on that issue of changing the burden of, shifting the burden of proof. We had never done that before. And I still can see one particular senator from Beaumont turning red on the floor trying to get those changes and to get a shift of that burden of proof so that the claimant did not have the burden of proof if the carrier appealed a decision related to income benefits. Well, he got that into the statute. He was successful in doing so. But the point was, they didn't do it in any other part of the statute at that time. So they didn't change a thing as it relates to medical review, with perhaps the exception of going from SOA into district court where it's substantial evidence review. What the ALJ did here was basically shift substantial evidence review into his courtroom. Because under substantial evidence review, you presume what the order below was is correct, and that the party asking for the hearing has to disprove it. Well, that's exactly what he asked us to do. He says, I've got an order here of $20,000. It's your job to disprove it. Well, we in fact did that. And even though the hospital had a witness there that could have contradicted anything our witness said, didn't do that.
And so as it relates to the burden of proof, it's your position that nothing the carrier was seeking at the de novo hearing could be construed as affirmative relief, and consequently Manbeck is controlling?
No, in respect to, the issues going into the hearing, one were whether there was a contract that applied, and if not, how much, I don't think anyone argued over how much would be due under the contract.
Well, is there evidence in the record of the contract between with Aetna?
Well, yes. Let me go into the notice issue. The notice issue began because when we all go in to see the doctor, you're not getting past the folks behind the glass wall with a little hole in it to find out how they're going to get paid. You're not going anywhere till that happens. And so with group coverage, you go in, you show them your card, so they can confirm that you've got, that an insurance company is going to pay for it. And they know how much, because now they know the insurance company and they know what deal they made with that particular insurance company, what contract they have for their fees. Well, in these cases, claimant comes in, they don't really know that. So the idea is, where can the hospital go to find out whether this insurance carrier or the workers' comp carrier has a contract on the backside? Mm-hmm. Well, the statute said the carrier can do that by a URL,
right.
Says so. That was in the contract, it says so.
That's the 133.4?
Yes.
Okay, where in the record do we find that support for the notice under 133.4?
Okay. There is, because these are confidential, we don't get the letter from the division that sent to Aetna says, give us your contract, because the contract is theoretically confidential. And so we're not supposed to get those, and we didn't. So we've got a letter from Aetna that says, we're sending you the contract, and we notified the hospital on the date of the contract, because the method of how they're determined who has coverage on the backside is in the URL, and that's in the contract. And so that's what they said. Our witness said the hospital knew they had received notice. They never contested at all that they didn't receive notice. The billing folks at the hospital all along understood that the contract applied. They asked for payment under the contract. And when they did their new bill, they asked for payment under the contract as well. They kind of dropped the pre-authorization issues, and we eventually got to the staff at the hospital saying, well, this is what we think we're due under the contract. And that's, from that point on, theoretically, the contract wasn't at issue until the MDRO voided it. They had never contested notice.
Thank you, Mr. Tipton. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. It's good to be here. May it please the court, I have a few points to make on behalf of the hospital, of course. I want to thank Mr. Tipton for another invitation to get back to Austin in the Third Court of Appeals. Wouldn't be here without him. But I'm going to start off with this issue of the contract, because this isn't like in workers' compensation. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about a system designed specifically for the stakeholders, which are injured workers, insurance carriers, and self-insured employers, and medical care providers. The whole system is designed to take care of that universe of people. It's got some very strange rules, some rules that don't always square with everything that we think of as lawyers as being normal or traditional or sacrosanct in other areas of law. And I've had to find that out the hard way, as have some of my clients. At any rate, I want to start off with the contract issue, because when you get a workers' compensation patient, you just get a patient. In this case, a physician needed to do a surgery to revise a neurostimulator in the back. The stimulator had failed. The stimulator itself is a little battery pack, and then it has leads that go into adjacent to the spine to deaden pain. You may know about that, but that's what a revision was. That was the procedure that was requested. That was the procedure that was pre-authorized. When it was done, nobody at Patients Medical Center had a clue who this patient's insurance company was. The pre-authorization was done through a third party called Unimed Direct. It's one of those utilization review agents that works for the carrier. We don't even know who the carrier is at that point. When our client's claim went out to be reviewed and paid, it went to Unimed Direct, not to Facility Insurance, not to Aetna. Nobody knew anything about Aetna. And by the way, we'll get as a backdrop for all these comments I'm making about the contract, my client has never, ever denied that it has a managed care agreement with Aetna. It has had one of those for a long time. The question is, was the notice, the proper notice given back when the type of notice that was required to the hospital to say, we're going to be accessing your facility under this managed care agreement? And the reason that was done, because there was a lot of trouble back in those days between, I'd say, about 2005 until 2011, when you could no longer have those kind of arrangements. In 2011, the agency required formal networks. And you had to have a written agreement or it wasn't going to work, period, between the parties. But in this earlier period, there was a lot of what it was referred to as silent PPO activity. Backdoor access to backdoor discounts, providers not knowing really who it is that's accessing other contracts. So the agency said, okay, if you're going to do an informal network arrangement, you've got to put the people on notice. That didn't happen here. And I want to explain what the rule requires. Make a couple of comments about that. The rule requires that the notice go out to the provider with the name, physical address, phone number of the person, the start date and end date of any such arrangement. We don't have anything in the record that shows that. Thirdly, the rule did say that it could be provided in an electronic format, and it could even be provided through a website if, and there are some ifs, it contains the information that I just read, the physical address, phone number, and so on of the party accessing the agreement, the starting and ending date of the arrangement. It also had to be updated at least monthly. Documentation had to be given to the agency to show that that had been done, and failure to comply with that creates a rebuttable presumption that the notice didn't happen. Well, the notice didn't happen in this case. The agency asked for that and by the way, that was, that's rule 28 TAC 133.4, which is appendix 4 in the Appellee's Index. Moving over in the appellant's documents, we have the letter at page 26 from Aetna. What this letter says, it says, let me go to the other page. In the appellant's reply brief, they say that the hospital at this point, now it's 2018, well, we could have dug through the agency's archives and found this notice. I don't think so, because in 2010, the agency asked for it. They said, and this is after medical dispute resolution had been requested. We said, okay, the agency asked for the contract and documentation to support that Patients Medical Center was notified in accordance with the rule I just referenced to you. The response was, Aetna sent a copy of our contract. They didn't provide the notice. It wasn't there. Now, that was in 2010. And if it was so easy to get in 2010, why didn't they provide it? I mean, surely they can go to their own website and do that and give it to the agency, but they didn't do it. So when it came time for the medical review division to review the matter and issue a decision, they found no notice. It wasn't given to the agency. It wasn't given to the ALJ later on. And 1343, does that mean I have 13 minutes remaining, or does that mean I've used up 13 minutes?
I think you remaining.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you. Because I want to, it's important to get to some of these other points. But before I get off of this issue, I want to talk about the appellant's reply brief. There's a document in here, which is Appendix 17 that we've never seen before. It's not contained in the record of this case. And it appears to be a last-ditch attempt by the carrier to show that somehow there was notice of this network arrangement on file with the agency at some point. It has no date on it. It was not in the record of the case at the DWC or at the ALJ level at SOA. And on the second page of it, first there's a first page, then there's a page break, and then a second page. If you go down about two-thirds of the way down, it says Facility Insurance Corporation, and it says through other. Coventry is what's listed next to it. Well, Coventry is indeed a nationwide PPO network. What this tells us is that Facility Insurance Corporation either has or had at some point in the past a relationship with Coventry Healthcare. It doesn't say anything about having a relationship with Patients Medical Center. The contract problem that the carrier has here is that it has never, ever connected the dots between Facility Insurance Corporation and Patients Medical Center, period. If Facility Insurance Corporation had the right to access my client's Aetna network agreement, they could have shown us that. I think they could have managed to do that, and they didn't do it. So that has just... that's a red herring that we need to get rid of in this case, and that is why when the agency went through its calculations, and by the way, when you read the medical dispute resolution officer's decision, it goes through the medical claim code by code, line by line, and explains exactly how it's calculated. Later, at the ALJ level, and of course that decision is issued without any testimony, it's a paper review at the agency, at the DWC. Subsequently, after ALJ review at that level, the evidence was not closed.
ALJ review, and
SOA review.
I want to make sure that we do touch on this idea of there being an issue with the de novo hearing at SOA.
Excuse me, Your Honor. I'm planning to go there next. I'm gonna skip past some other things so we can get to that right now. I think both at the ALJ level and in the district court, the court there was satisfied that the hospital had submitted a complete claim. Its original claim was a complete claim. Just on that point, let me get past that and move on to burden of proof. This issue about a complete claim and a subsequently filed claim. There was only one claim that was complete. The original one submitted was, in fact, complete. It just had codes on it that the carrier didn't want to pay. Insurance carriers get claims all the time that they see something and say, well, that wasn't pre-authorized, or we're not going to pay for that, or this charge should be included with the fee for another procedure, something like that. That happens all the time. It didn't make our claim incomplete, and it was not incomplete. And that is why the carrier adjudicated it, and that's how that claim ended up before the DWC and then subsequently in SOA. Now, on the issue of burden of proof, it's a hybrid system. My take on that, I read a lot about it, and I had to go back and look at what the Supreme Court and what this court has said about agency power, agency discretion, agency authority. I admit I don't have the cite for it, but I recall a case called Patient Advocates of Texas that was heard by this court, and we filed an amicus in it. In that case, agency authority and discretion in their rulemaking and how they run their operation is specifically discussed with respect to the, I think it was still the TWCC at the time, not Division of Workers' Compensation. But we have the case of, of course, this court's familiar with, leading case, or at least one of the leading case on an agency's power and implied powers expressed through its statutory authority given to it to do what it's supposed to do to carry out its mission. Leading case on that, or one of them, is Sexton versus Mount Olivet Cemetery Association, 720 Southwest 2nd 129, from this court, 1986, and that was holding in that court, endorsed by the Supreme Court, in PUC versus GTE Southwest 901 Southwest 2nd 401. The quote from that, with that site, is the legislature generally intends that an agency should have by implication such authority as may be necessary to carry out the specific delegated power delegated in order that the statutory purpose might be achieved. Okay. Well, moving on from that, we think the agency has the authority to do what it does. And de novo, again, looking at de novo and burden of proof, two different things. Carrier wants a de novo review. Okay, fine. They got a de novo review. That's scope of discovery, scope of developing the record. What the agency talked about in the preamble to the rulemaking is, are we giving a forum, are we allowing a forum or a venue where the party can completely develop a record, do discovery, take depositions, do whatever they need to do at the SOA level? And the answer is yes. They get to do anything and everything they want to do. The only thing you don't get is a trial by jury at SOA. In this case, the carrier served no discovery, took no depositions, served no subpoenas, didn't do any of the things that it could have done, but yet it's here complaining today that it didn't get a de novo review.
Well, but who is the party that initiated the process at the agency?
The hospital initiated the medical dispute resolution process at the Division of Workers' Compensation.
Okay. So they just to kind of put it in generic terms, your client is the party that initiated the process in order to seek relief.
That is correct.
And so we have this hearing before the INDRO, and I forget exactly what that stands for, but...
Medical Dispute Resolution Officer.
All right.
That's, again, we're not there. It's, you just get a piece of paper in the mail one day.
Okay.
Here's your order.
So that Dispute Resolution Officer decides whatever they decide, and once the de novo hearing occurs, does that not essentially just negate and void out everything that has happened up to that point in time? And
well, theoretically,
the process starts anew with the hospital still being the party requesting relief before SOA?
Theoretically, that's correct. I mean, we're starting over, but we have the same set of facts. We still all have the same evidence.
Right, but then the hospital is the party that bears the burden of proof and sets forth the evidence that is necessary for it to establish its entitlement to the claim that it's making.
Well, that's not what the law says. What the labor code says, there are, let me get back to where my note was. Yeah, labor code says that...
And where are you?
Regarding the burden of proof, rule 1, be 28 TAC 148.14, burden of proof. That says the commission has the burden of proof in hearings pursuant to the act, except under certain other issues. Then it goes on. The burden of proof rests with the, this, I'll read you the relevant part here, and that's under rule 148.14 of the agency's rules. The burden of proof rests with the party seeking relief in hearings conducted pursuant to the act, sections 408.024, 413.031. That's where the medical dispute resolution part comes in. And when you go to SOA's rule, see, that's you go to SOA's rule, it tells you, and this is the judge, we think, did it correctly, in determining which party bears the burden of proof, the judge shall first consider the applicable statute. Well, that goes back and looks at the labor code, and the labor code says what I just said, that the party with the burden of proof is the one seeking relief at SOA.
But in a trial de novo, you're still the party seeking relief, are you not?
Yes, we are. We are still the party seeking relief. Well, we are a party seeking relief. We are a party seeking relief.
But does not that then place upon you the burden to establish your case?
If the carrier doesn't appeal, that order becomes final, and that's it. So they are appealing. They are seeking relief. They do nothing. That order from the agency becomes final.
But I think you're according finality to the decision that was made by the dispute resolution officer. And it seems as though once the trial de novo is invoked, there is no finality to accord to that decision. You're placed in exactly the same
we are
position
starting again,
that you would have been placed, that you were in front of the IMDRO.
I believe I see where the court's going with this, but again, the only thing that would have made any difference substantively, and the only thing that will make any difference substantively or that could be done, is to do a motion to realign the parties, if that's what it takes. It's a de novo review of the claim.
Those two words are incompatible essentially with one another. It's a de novo hearing. It's to say review implies that you're reviewing what transpired below, and that's not correct, is it?
The evidence that's developed below, at least part of it, is part of the record there. So yeah, it comes in. Everything that was admitted into evidence or taken into evidence and considered at the agency was admitted into evidence in the SOA process. But we went beyond that. Either side could have done whatever discovery they wanted to do. We covered the issue of our claim and what our client was owed. We did put on proof and post-trial, both by presenting our chief financial officer by telephone at the hearing and by going through the claim calculations and the reimbursement calculations in post-trial briefing. To say we put on no evidence would be completely incorrect. And to say that a de novo hearing, a de novo review was not had, or we don't like the phrase de novo review, a de novo hearing, that it didn't occur, I think is incorrect. The parties had the full scope of all discovery tools, the evidentiary rules, and so on available to them. That's the way that works.
And I understand that. It strikes me as assuming all that we've heard here to be true to place upon the party that was not seeking relief below the burden to disprove the validity and the accuracy of what took place in front of the dispute resolution officer is turning de novo hearing on its head.
Well, we brought the same evidence, only I guess a good way to put it would be we brought it, instead of on paper, we brought it live by presenting the chief financial officer and additional documentation, testimony, and so on. So the de novo hearing happened. We brought it, and the carrier had an attempt, an opportunity to refute it at that hearing. So I would argue that a de novo hearing was, in fact, exactly what they got. And the burden of proof issue is covered by the rules.
All right, sir. Thank you, Mr. Holloway.
Thank you.
May I please the court? And before I address specifically some questions, going back to Justice Goodwin's question about harm, when you go to the calculations that the INDRO did, her mistake had to do with the calculation of outlier payments. And the fact that she included in those calculations things the carrier was not responsible for. And that's when I first said, all these mistakes go back to the original coding. The coder put on the bill the charges for three implants that totaled $63,000 out of the $94,000 of this bill. And the carrier was not responsible for any of those, as it related to the charge of $47,000 for the neurotransmitter. That was not, the insertion of a new transmitter was not billed by the hospital. That code was not billed. They did not ask for pre-authorization for that code. Pre-authorization wasn't granted for that code. The ALJ, in reading the operative report, says, no, I agree, they didn't insert a new stimulator. And the operative report says all they did was take out the old one, reconnect it up the leads, and put it back in the pocket. That's a revision of that stimulator. And the MDRO properly found that that had not been pre-authorized and they didn't appeal it. So from both the electrode standpoint and from the stimulator standpoint, the carrier was not legally liable for them whether they used them or not. But the evidence shows they didn't use the stimulator, but it was on the bill anyway. And so we were ordered to pay outlier payments based upon $47,000 in charges that didn't occur. They didn't use the stimulator. Now, the electrode's a little bit different in that the doctor called it a revision, and if you look at the operative report, it's really unclear whether he put in new ones or not. But the point is, they didn't ask for pre-authorization for putting in new electrodes. We don't know whether they used them or not. The only glitch is, there is a letter from the hospital's staff saying, well, we talked to the Medtronic rep, and he says, well, they don't say what he said, but they said, well, we would like to get paid for the electrodes, which implies they believe new electrodes have been put in, even though the operative report said it was only a revision. And a revision means you take it out or put it back in. And I'll also say I may have misrepresented, I think, what the ALJ said in respect to the stimulator or the electrodes. He uses the word replace. I took him to mean that they replaced it with a new one or with new electrodes. Well, the definition of replace actually covers revision and placement of a new one, if you look at the definition. So it really covers both those things. So I really think, based upon the fact he called it a revision, which is a term of art, meaning for the electrodes, all you did was move them someplace else because they had, according to the doctor, migrated. So it's pretty clear they probably didn't use those either.
But counsel, before you run out of time, would you speak to the notice issue?
All right. The Appendix 17, if counsel would read actually the beginning of it as to what network these report, this is in Appendix 17, it shows that the carrier, that Aetna complied with the notice provisions under 133.4 and 5 because that's where this data comes from. They had to report that to the...
This is a Department of Insurance document.
Department of Insurance documentation. So I responded in my reply because in their reply brief, they said, well, you're confused about what contract we're talking about. We're talking about the contract between the workers' comp carrier and Aetna. You didn't put that into evidence, and you were asked for that by the division. Well, the letter from the division doesn't ask for that, nor does the rule, because the question is for the agency is how much ought to be paid under the contract. They don't need the contract between the workers' comp carrier and Aetna, and they didn't ask for it in their letter, and they never do. But it was noted here that, in fact, Facility Insurance Company had that contract with Aetna. And what the rule says, if you look at the preamble, that's in our appendix, they explain what they meant by that. They didn't, because the complaint was, well, how do we know, how do we document whether the hospital actually read if we sent it to in letter form or if we sent it in as electronic form or if it's on the website? Are you telling us we have to prove they actually read it? And especially with a website, I mean, how do you do that? So what the agency said was you're not required to show the content of that. What you're required to show is the time that you notified them of where to get the information and the manner in which they would get that information. And that's all the rule meant, and that's what they say in the preamble. So that's exactly what happened here. Aetna sent them the contract and said the contract, you know, look at the contract, if you read it, the URL's there, and they knew of it when we sent it to them. And they talk about, he said something about evidence. He was asked two questions by their attorney related to the contract. One, do you know anything about the contract? No. Do you know anything about notice? No. Why? Because he wasn't there at the time. That's their evidence. And they ask him no questions about how much was due under the guideline. Not a peep out of him for that, even though he was available to contradict all the evidence the carrier had.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Tipton. Thank both of you for your presentation. And the case will be submitted for consideration. The court will be in recess.